Literally from the North Shore presents Dean Hovey's book Whistling Sousa in 14 episodes. This is episode 4.
Every winter, the Lester Park Community Theater stages 3 plays, and Mother always has a role in each of them. Her position, cemented by her ability to emote on stage and her generous contributions. She's rarely found time for me, her only child, except for our Sunday evening call. The conversations are always one-sided and have only one topic, Mother. My father had been a successful criminal lawyer in Duluth, which left my mother free of the burdens of needing a second income, managing a household budget, paying bills, or even knowing how much money they had or where the money was located. When my father was killed in an accident on I-35 while driving to a trial in Carlton County, his life insurance went into a trust along with the cash from his partners buying out his share of the law practice. The trust provides Mother a handsome monthly check, which she shares freely. She embodies the stereotype of the guilty rich Democratic Party supporter. The money allows her to do all the philanthropic things she wants without the worry of paying for things. The major source of friction between us is my matching trust account. I choose not to draw on it, preferring to live on my Whistling Pines income rather than my father's legacy. Our second source of friction is that I haven't produced an heir to father's fortune. That's led to a third source of friction, which is Jenny, who already has a son. You can do better than marrying a woman with baggage, Mother repeatedly tells me. My parents haven't met your mother. This may be our chance, Jenny was saying. Jenny's mother is perfect. Barbara has sculpted beauty and poise, neither of which ever cracks or wrinkles. Her clothes are always freshly pressed, her makeup tasteful, her jewelry understated, limited to tiny diamonds and stud earrings and a wedding band. Jenny's father is a successful insurance broker. Howard drives a Cadillac, plays golf, drinks martinis, and never swears. He's voted a straight Republican ticket in every election since turning 21. My mother, Audrey, puts on makeup with a trowel and wears flowing dresses designed to cover up her expansive girth. Jewelry is more than an accessory for her. It's her persona. My father showered Mother with jewelry for birthdays and Christmas presents. She drapes her neck with mismatched necklaces, and she wears dangling earrings and gold bangles that clank against each other when she waves her arms. And she always waves her arms. Her arms flail emphatically through all conversations as if she was on stage. And she talks, ranting about poor funding of the schools, the Nazi tactics of the Republican Party, the unfairness of property taxes, and whatever she's adopted as her latest charity cause. She gives generously and works tirelessly for every Democratic Party candidate who holds elective office in Duluth. After a couple of glasses of wine, she swears like a drill instructor when she argues politics. I loathed the thought of her sharing a table with Jenny's quiet, polished Republican parents who wouldn't say crap if they had a mouthful of it. Jenny was reading my mind, a superpower she uses routinely. They have to meet sometime, she said. Can I come along? I like Peter's mother. Wendy had been in several musical productions at the Lester Park Theater and knew my mother well. Wendy also knew I was uncomfortable with my maternal relationship and loved to poke me when she had the chance. I'll give Mother a call, I said, as my stomach churned. Peter, Wendy said as I turned to leave. Who was the killer in Manila? She asked, staring at the crossword puzzle. Muhammad Ali, I replied. Wendy looked at the puzzle and frowned. It's only 3 letters. Ali, A-L-I. Perfect, she said, filling the letters in the squares. She jumped up and pushed past me. I've got to gas up the van. I'll see you under the portico in 15 minutes. How do you know all the answers? Jenny asked, having seen me supply a correct answer for every crossword clue that Wendy posed. They just come to me. Jenny looked around and handed me a doctor's order. Read this.
What?
Just read it, she replied. I quickly scanned the document and returned it to her. Holdepacker is having a minor surgical procedure, I said. So what?
How are they doing the procedure?
Laparoscopically.
Spell it for me.
Laparoscopically.
Where does it say that in the note?
It's the eighth word of the fourth sentence in the second paragraph.
Jenny smiled. You have a photographic memory. That's why I've never seen you read music when you play. You can remember all the notes.
I shrugged.
How far back can you remember? She asked.
I used to be able to remember things back to grade school. I lost a lot in Iraq.
Lost it because of the physical or mental trauma? She asked.
I don't know, I said, flashing back to the inside of the Humvee, rolling after being struck by the shockwave from an exploding IED. My helmet protected my head as it banged against the ceiling and both sides before the Humvee came to rest with me lying on the ceiling. I'm sure Marines were yelling for me, the corpsman, but it was several days before my hearing returned. I climbed out and, out of instinct, responded to what I saw as the greatest carnage. I was later told that there were bullets ricocheting off the armored trucks all around me, and the Marines were impressed with my selfless attempts to rescue their buddies. In reality, I didn't react to the ricochets because I couldn't hear a thing. The next day, Lieutenant Pittman, a new Annapolis graduate, stopped me after lunch and slapped me on the back. He told me I was either crazy or some damned brave idiot who didn't know enough to keep my head down during a firefight. He thanked me for dragging one Marine out of Withering Crossfire and behind the Humvee. He said he'd nominated me for the Bronze Star with a V for Valor. I was still half deaf and too embarrassed to tell him I couldn't hear the gunfire. Jenny saw me glaze over and quickly moved to pull me back from Iraq. Are you okay with your mother meeting my folks at the fair? After a moment, I was able to clear the Iraq memories and answer, Mother dresses like a gypsy and argues with Republicans. What can go wrong?
They'll be together at a wedding someday, Jenny replied.
I may not pop the question until after Mother dies.
How old is she?
I did the math in my head. She's 50-something.
She wants a grandchild.
I froze at the reality of Jenny's words.
Probably, I replied.
She pulled me close and whispered in my ear, We're both in our 30s. Having a child together might not be a sure thing in a few years. Whistling Sousa, Chapter 8. I grabbed the Friday sign-up list for the van and hurried to the front door where the residents were lining up for the ride. Howard Johnson, the self-appointed mayor of Whistling Pines, was near the front of the line. He was a magnet for the disgruntled and meek residents who, for whatever reason, were unwilling to take their grievances to the management. He was having a hushed discussion with Dottie Preston. Dottie blushed and turned away as I approached.
Howard, I was surprised to see your name on the list for the van. I thought you'd drive yourself to the fair.
Howard, impeccably dressed in a white golf shirt and khaki pants with a crease that could cut butter, smiled.
The parking at the fair is terrible, and you drop us at the front gate. It's much easier.
I motioned for Howard to follow me to the aviary, a few feet away from the entrance.
What's Dottie's issue? I asked.
I anticipated that she was concerned about Tinker's injuries.
Howard turned his back to the people in line and leaned close to my ear.
Dottie heard that you'd been asked to fill in for the city band conductor and is a little upset because you're not from Two Harbors.
Howard mistook my smile for impertinence. Did I say something funny?
Not at all, I replied. I only received the call this morning, and I think it's funny the news has already hit the Whistling Pines party line.
Howard smiled. It's not surprising at all. John Carr called me last night to ask if you were really up to the task. I told him that you played a half dozen instruments, had an amazing ear, and a degree in music from the university. I think that your qualifications are better than anyone in the band."
"That's very kind."
Howard patted my shoulder. "Too bad you're not from around here."
Whistling Sousa, Chapter 9.
I'd drawn two women, Pixie Kangas and Connie Danielski, as my two seniors for the day, and instead of a tour of the livestock barns, we shuffled to the 4-H building, where the art and craft projects were displayed. The projects ran from paintings to photographs to homemade quilts and woodworking. We stopped at each, weighing the quality of the workmanship against the family lineage of the creator. Pixie was examining a taxidermy mount of a large northern pike. The workmanship was crude, reflecting the age, 13, of the artist. The eyes were too large, the white spots were irregular, and the skin, which should have been smooth, was rippled where it had been folded or mishandled. The mouth was open, and he'd apparently filled it with plaster of Paris that he'd painted pink. "Oh, dear," Pixie said, "Shelby's grandson did this fish, and I can't even tell what type of trout it is." "I think it's a northern pike," I replied. "Look at the teeth." Connie, who was in need of cataract surgery, stared in the fish's mouth. "It looks like a big-mouth bass to me. They're not much good for eating, but the boys sure had a good time catching them."
"I think the judges should give him at least a white ribbon," Pixie said. "His father volunteers at the animal shelter, and he's such a nice man."
"Don't you think the judges should choose the best workmanship?" I asked.
"Oh, I don't think so," Connie said. "You don't want to give a prize to some stinker just because his work is good, do you?"
I let the question dangle as we made our way through the rest of the steel building. We stopped at the Lutheran Church lunch counter and had coffee and homemade donuts. By the time we got on the van, I was mentally wasted and physically exhausted. A man I didn't recognize was sitting on the bench under the Whistling Pines portico, wearing a Tyrolean hat and lederhosen. A nylon briefcase hung from a shoulder strap. He approached me as the last of the oldsters left the van. He offered his hand and introduced himself. "I'm Brian Johnson. John Carr said you'd be expecting me." I estimated him to be about 60, with a round face, thinning hair, and bushy eyebrows. He was stocky, like many of the tuba players I'd met.
"Ah," I said, shaking his hand, "you're Brian the tuba player who is bringing music."
Brian saw my reaction to his outfit and said, "I just came from the fair. My polka band was playing at the fairgrounds."
"Your outfit isn't something I'd expect to see wandering two harbors," I said.
He slid the briefcase strap from his shoulder. "Is there somewhere we could sit down to review the music for the concert?" I directed him to my office and cleared the visitor's chair. "John said you are the assistant director. I hope I'm not stepping on your toes by taking the baton for this concert." Brian gave me a sour look as he took the neatly clipped stack of music out of the briefcase and arranged the pages on his lap. Yellow tabs stuck out of the stack. He handed me a single sheet of paper. "Here's the music set we've been practicing for the fair." Handing me a second sheet, he said, "and here's the music for the year-end concert at the Bandshell." The first sheet reminded me of the music I had heard them play when Jenny and I had attended their summer concerts, a variety running from popular songs to big band favorites from the 40s. I looked through the second sheet and noted that all the songs were marches, running from classical composers to the ending with Sousa's Stars and Stripes Forever. "How much experience do you have as a conductor?" he asked. "Well, I have a little conducting experience," I said, reflecting on a Christmas concert I had arranged in Iraq. "I have a bachelor's degree in instrumental music and a pretty fair ear."
"Huh," he replied. He was unimpressed with my credentials.
Is there anything special I should know before the concerts?
I took the music and set the pile atop my desk.
Well, he paused, apparently unprepared for the question, the band is diverse, with high school kids and retirees. The trombone players are mostly goofy. The clarinet players are always mad because the trombone players blow their spitcocks right behind the clarinet players' chairs.
How are the trombones goofy? I asked.
Well, there's Billy Chicken Paulson. He used to drive down the highway in the wrong lane to make the oncoming cars veer into the ditch. He may be the most normal of the lot.
He paused and then opened up. I'm not entirely happy with you taking over the band because I'm the assistant director, but you can't play tuba, and John Carr convinced me that we need a tuba more than we need me as a conductor.
That's not exactly a vote of confidence.
It's nothing against you, it's just...
I'm not from Two Harbors, I finished.
Well, there's that, but besides that, you've never played with us. I've heard that you're good, but you've never picked up an instrument with us. I don't even know what you can play.
Do you play anything other than guitar?
I'm pretty good on guitar, piano, clarinet, and alto sax. I've dabbled with the flute, but skipped most of the brass section when I was learning instruments.
You're not going to change any of the arrangements, are you? Brian asked defensively.
I looked at the pile of music. Not a chance. I won't have the time even if I wanted to make changes.
Brian smiled. That's one of the things that can get people's undies in a bunch.
What else should I avoid?
Well, the band's dress code for shirt nights is a white shirt, red tie, and black pants. Show up half an hour early, but don't be surprised if the bassoonist doesn't show up until you're ready on the podium.
Oh, and don't be surprised if one of the male musicians shows up in a dress.
When I raised my eyebrows, he explained.
Gerald Bowden is in the middle of becoming Jesse. It's no problem when we're wearing our uniforms, but on shirt nights, I'm never sure if he'll be in slacks or a skirt. It's not a big deal. It's just a little unsettling not to know. Of course, it's just strange for a six-foot guy to show up with his braless, B-cup boobs in a white shirt and ponytail. He paused and then added, it's kind of hard not to stare, if you know what I mean.
I've never met anyone transgender. I'll try not to stare.
The more Brian spoke, the more comfortable he became with me.
Well, just be prepared and know that not everyone is as open-minded as you and I are.
I smiled. You warned me about the trombones, but I've always heard that it was the tuba and bass players who were the troublemakers.
Brian smiled.
Two tuba players are sitting at a bar. Which one is drinking?
I don't know.
It's a trick question. Everyone knows both would be drinking.
He replied as he smiled and stood.
I won't cause you any trouble, but look out for the trumpets. They all think that they should be first chair, so John rotates them annually. They may try to make their cases with you.
Why would they do that? I'm only filling in for a couple weeks.
Brian smiled. John was a little evasive with you. The season is ending, and we only have the county fair concert on Saturday, and then the year-end concert in the park bandshell next Thursday. We need you to fill in for both these events, and that's plenty of time for people to express their frustrations and distrust.
I was suddenly overwhelmed, given my responsibilities at Whistling Pines, trying to get justice for Tinker and now filling in as the band director.
Wendy surprised us when she stepped into my crowded office, leaving none of us with adequate personal space.
I heard that you're doing Gilbert and Sullivan for the year-end city band concert, Peter. I think we should do the Baroness and Rudolph duet.
When she saw my look of surprise, she broke into song with a resonant alto voice.
As o'er our penny roll we sing, it's not reprehensive to think what joys our wealth would bring when we're disposed to do the thing upon a scale extensive. There's rich mock turtle, thick and clear.
She stopped, apparently expecting me to sing the next verse. I was dumbstruck.
Brian looked like he was ready to push the crazy woman aside and run.
"I'm afraid I'm not familiar with that song," I said, trying to evade the issue. Wendy pulled out a sheet of music and lyrics and handed it to me. "You're a really quick study. I'm sure you could master this in a couple of days." Brian looked at me with panic in his eyes. "The county fair concert is tomorrow night, and the last concert is always marches. If we did Gilbert and Sullivan, we'd have to practice and play it earlier in the year." Wendy gave Brian her best disarming smile and bumped her ample hip into his. "Come on, it's time for you guys to open up the playlist and have some fun." Brian, obviously unaccustomed to someone as forward as Wendy, looked like he'd swallowed a peach pit. "Are you married?" Wendy asked, reveling in his discomfort as his chubby cheeks turned red. Yes, he replied, lifting his left hand to show his wedding ring. "Happily married?" she asked, leaning forward and exposing the top of a teddy bear tattoo in her cleavage. Brian's eyes drifted to the tattoo for a second and then snapped back to Wendy's smiling face. "Yes, happily married. It's a pity that all the good ones are taken." With that, she swept out of my office as quickly as she'd appeared. Brian stared at the open door for a second and then looked back at me. "Who was that?" "Wendy is the assistant director and also fills in with the music program. She sings and plays piano. She's also the lead singer for the Gin Fizzes, a local band. When we do vocal music, my wife is the soloist. She might do you serious harm if she were unexpectedly displaced by your tattooed friend. Believe me, I have no plans to change anything, and I'll be happy to hand the baton back to John when he's well. For your sake, I hope that's all you do." With that cryptic comment, Brian was gone. Whistling Sousa, Chapter 10, Friday Evening. I was nearly home when I saw my neighbor Dolores waving at me from her front porch. Dolores has no family, so she depends on my regular assistance with tasks that are beyond her capabilities. When I got to the porch with the music under my arm, I realized she was wearing only one of her black orthopedic shoes. My gut told me this wasn't a good situation. "Peter, I'm so pleased you're home," she said, quickly turning her back on me and limping into the house. I reluctantly followed her. She sat in an ancient brocade-covered chair and pulled her bare foot onto the matching hassock. She then aimed what appeared to be a cell phone at her foot and held it up at arm's length. "What's up?" I asked. "I'm trying to get a picture of my toe so I can email it to my doctor." She stabbed something on the face of the cell phone's digital screen with such force that the phone twisted in her fingers. "Damn, I just can't get a decent picture." I looked at Dolores's bare left foot and saw that her big toe was an ugly shade of black. "What happened to your toe?" I asked. "The doctor said it's the damned diabetes. I think it's just because I stubbed it on the leg of my dresser," she replied. She reoriented the phone and tried another picture with the same result. "Here, Peter, you take the picture." I took the cell phone and looked at the unfamiliar screen. "Why do you want a picture of your toe?" "I told you, I'm going to email it to the doctor. It's getting worse, and I can't get the nurse to do anything about it over the phone. I thought that an email directly to the doctor might yield better results than dealing with the help." Dolores and her husband had been well off and employed a maid and a cook through much of their lives. I shuddered at her characterization of the doctor's triage nurse as the help. "Why don't you just get an appointment?" I asked, looking at the screen and locating a button that looked like an electronic version of a shutter release. I framed the toe and gently pushed the button. The screen froze, the phone made an audible click, and we had a perfect picture of Dolores's black toe. "They charge a copay for office visits, but emails and phone calls are free," she explained. I handed the phone to her and watched as she moved through screens, then keyed in an email address with her arthritic fingers. I was amazed at her skill in navigating the technology and wondered to myself how many Whistling Pines residents would have the mental acuity and manual dexterity to manage the tiny phone. After a minute, she paused and said, "There. Now help me with my hosiery." I slid her support hose over the discolored toe and stopped discreetly halfway up her calf. "Are you sure you're able to walk around the house with this toe?" I asked. "Are you joking? I'm going to the fair tomorrow." "Isn't the black toe causing you a lot of pain?" "Oh, no," she replied as I carefully slid her heavy orthopedic shoe over the black toe. "It's so much better than when it was purple." I was tempted to explain that this was an unfortunate series of events that would end in a bad outcome for the toe if it remained black, but she seemed pleased, so I let it pass. "I heard you are the guest conductor for the city band concert at the fair. That should be challenging," she said, standing up and teetering for a second. "How will that be challenging?" She shuffled to an antique desk and pulled open a drawer. "Well, there are some very interesting people in the band, and some very strong personalities. It's taken an assertive director to keep them all playing on the same page." She reached into the drawer and withdrew a small case. "I played in the band for 30 years until I couldn't march in the Heritage Days parade anymore." She shuffled back to me with the tiny case in her hand. "What instruments do you play?" she asked. "At Whistling Pines, I play piano and guitar most of the time. I've played clarinet, dabbled with some of the other woodwinds, and could play most of them with a little practice." She handed me the box and said, "Give this a try." Inside the box was a sterling silver piccolo with a tiny inscription in German. I put the box on a table and removed the two pieces, fitting them together gently. "Dolores, this is very valuable. I don't even want to touch it," I said, gently bringing it to my lips and trying to play a few notes. After a few tries, I pinched my lips tight enough to get the piccolo to chirp. The piccolo was much harder than the flute. I played a few notes and then held it to appreciate the fine workmanship. "Where did you get this?" I asked. "I played piccolo in high school and with the city band for a few years. I started with a ratty old piccolo that I purchased from a music store in Duluth. It was chipped and scratched, but it played well. I was seeing a young man who was taken with my musical ability. One year, for Christmas, he gave me this piccolo and promised it would be followed by a diamond ring." "That was your husband?" I asked. Tears formed in Dolores's rheumy eyes, and she shook a dainty handkerchief from her sleeve. She lifted her glasses and dabbed at her eyes. "Yes," she croaked, unable to say more. She closed her eyes and took several deep breaths. "Please take this. It needs a better home than my dusty drawer." "I can't accept this. It's too valuable." "Don't be ridiculous," she said with a smile. "I have no heirs, and who else would appreciate this Gemeinhardt instrument?" I gently pulled the pieces apart. "Thank you." "Will you be at the fair tomorrow?" she asked as I put the pieces back into the case.
The past 2 weeks' episodes of this program can be listened to from the ktwh.org website. Simply click on Literally from the North Shore from the program's drop-down menu found at the top of the homepage to listen to the archived shows.